Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, a day with significance for me, February the 7th, 2022. And the reason Monday has significance is because I now think of them as Mondays with Jimmy Sexton, where we continue our discussion of that great book, Charles Adams, For Good and Evil. And we discuss his magnificent 27 lessons, one lesson at a time. Today we are at lesson 12. But first, Jimmy, what's happening? How are you today?
I'm fantastic. It's Monday here in Dubai. It's sunny, it's warm, and life is good. There's no taxes. So, you know.
Oh my God, it must feel confusing to get into these kinds of discussions once a week.
No, I love it because I feel so lucky that it doesn't impact me so much.
Absolutely. Well, you know, this is a series of discussions about Charles Adams' lessons about taxation and the rise and fall of civilizations and our efforts to, you know, move his 1990 discussion into the 2020. And today we have a deceptively complex but interesting topic. And here's lesson 12. Taxes have been, more often than not, the cause of revolution. People seldom rise up and revolt if their tax burdens are reasonable. Well, to start this off, would you agree that we have reached a point in history where tax burdens are increasingly unreasonable?
Absolutely.
And would you agree that people are conscious of the unreasonableness of these burdens and are making changes in their lives because of it?
I think that as time goes on and the taxes become increasingly more unreasonable and impact a larger number, the unreasonableness impacts a larger number of people, that more and more people are becoming aware of it on a daily basis. And I think that's the first step, right? I think there are more and more people taking action, but I think even more people will take action as the unreasonableness increases to a level that is not acceptable to the people anymore.
It's interesting, when I read that deceptively simple concept that he lays out, if their tax burdens are reasonable, I suppose one way of viewing reasonableness is how much is being taken from them. But there are other aspects of it, how hard it is to comply. But I think a very interesting aspect of it also is, how do their tax burdens differ from those of their neighbors? And perhaps we could start with this. On Thursday, Professor Dorothy Brown of Emory Law School, who wrote the book, The Whiteness of Wealth, is continuing one of her sessions where she continues her discussion explaining how the tax code discriminates against various groups. In her case, the focus is on the Black community. But would you agree that part of being reasonableness is reasonable in relation to other people as well?
Yeah, it needs to be fair and administered the same to all citizens.
And you, I presume, are of the view that at the moment, the United States has a number of different tax systems that really are, tell me who you are and I'll tell you which tax system applies to you.
Yeah, I would agree that the taxes definitely do not apply equally to all people. To all citizens of the United States. It's certainly true. There's definitely different tax systems depending on where you fall.
How can this be justified? I mean, for example,
go ahead.
You have a lot of experience with the whole Americans abroad issue, and you know, I'm sure that you would agree that Americans abroad are actually subjected to a very different tax system than resident Americans.
Well, I think, I mean, look, if I were the government and I had to argue that it was fair and reasonable, I would argue that the tax system that applies to Americans abroad applies equally to all Americans, because if any American moves abroad, they're going to be subject to the same tax system. And I think that's how they probably justify its fairness.
Sort of like 17th century France, the law and its majestic equality prohibits both the rich and the poor equally from sleeping on the park bench.
Yep. But, you know, my personal opinion is, while I totally agree with you that the reasonableness is a measure also, you know, of course, how it applies between one citizen to the next, between neighbors. But I think that reasonableness, at least in terms of an individual analysis on each taxpayer, probably evaluates it by a standard of whether they're getting value for their tax dollars spent, right? I think that most taxpayers look at this very subjectively through the lens of what value am I getting in return? And if we take your example of Americans abroad, I think that if Americans abroad were getting value for their, I don't want to just say tax dollars, but getting value for the taxes they comply with, let's put it that way, right? So the filing of the returns, the payment of whatever taxes they owe, I think they would jump through these hoops if they thought that what they were getting in return was of enough value to make this hassle and this tax reasonable. And obviously, as the increase in, you know, as more and more people expatriate, it shows that more and more people think that it's not reasonable. But I think that overall, even when you're talking about Americans in America, you're talking about Europeans in different countries in Europe. I think when you look at citizens and residents of any high tax country, they're increasingly looking and saying, is the tax that I'm paying to my government reasonable? Am I getting value for my money? And when you look at so many countries that spend so much money running their bureaucracy on foreign aid, on all these things that don't benefit their citizens, the answer that these people can come to is, I'm not getting good value for my money. Therefore, the tax is unreasonable.
Well, I think that's pretty clear. And Charles Adams, writing in 1990, refers to the cause of revolution. And there are different kinds of revolutions. I mean, there's violent insurrection, I suppose, which would have happened to the Tsars in Russia in, I guess, 1917, only because they didn't have a modern tax code, I suppose. But I think that the what's meant by revolution in 2020 in the 21st century is really expatriation. I'm done. I'm out of here. Leaving.
Well, I'm not 100% sure that I agree completely with that, because when in going through the book, there's sort of a cycle that seems to happen, right? So first comes rampant tax evasion. Then comes revolution with the feet, leaving, right? Fleeing. You see the great brain drain. And then the next step after that is violent revolution. So, I think that in 12, he's talking about, in lesson 12, he's talking about violent revolution. And I think that expatriation, whether it's from the United States or simply leaving your country of residence in another high tax country, is the precursor to an eventual violent revolution. If history is any indicator, which it seems to usually be a pretty good, history repeats itself.
Well, that's interesting. Now, what are some of the examples that he gave in his tour through history on this? What violent revolutions?
Well, I mean, I think one of them was obviously, it's a very good question, because I don't recall the names of them off the top of my head, but I think that when you look at Rome, for example, well, Rome got conquered, didn't they? It wasn't really a revolution, if I remember correctly.
Well, there's no question that however you characterize the taxation led to its demise.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that there's been, I think when you look at, you know, I mean, even when you look at Israel and a lot of the different, you know, there was tax, the Israelis, there was tax revolts against the Romans. I mean, I think there's always throughout history been violent revolts against unreasonable taxation.
Yeah, but and that's certainly true. But as the world changes, as technology changes, I wonder if people aren't expressing this in a lot of ways. In other words, the modern world gives ways of expressing revolution, in ways that are less visible and don't involve direct violence and that sort of thing. But I mean, let me ask you this. There's a lot of discussion right now in North America about the, the January 6th incident before the Biden inauguration. That's a revolt. Agreed.
Yeah.
However else you may characterize it, it's a revolt. Could one step back and look at that and say, well, that is in part related to issues of unfair taxation?
I would say this, and I'm going to go a little bit further than the January 6th riots. And I'm going to say there's been a lot of revolts happening lately, including where you are in Canada, against these what I consider to be very unreasonable COVID restrictions. And I think that these protests, revolts, uprisings, whatever you want to call them, are, I think people have a lot of pent-up anger against their governments, in part because of unreasonable high taxation. And when their personal freedom was taken away for what most people seem to think is an overexertion of government power, that's now resulted in some uprisings that probably has more to do with other underlying reasons than directly COVID. But I think that what we're seeing is that people are willing to take to the streets. People are willing to take action. And it hasn't gotten, January 6th was violent. And I know that some of these protests and stuff have had some violence, but it hasn't been mass violence. But I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't change in the future. I think that this is the beginning of more revolt as governments become exert more unreasonable power over their citizens, and certainly tax is a part of that.
I think that's a good way of looking at it, and I think it makes it clear that taxes is one of the issues. But I'd be interested in more of your views of how this Freedom Convoy 2022, I think that's what it's called in Canada, is being observed throughout the world. I mean, I started my day, as I often do, reading the New York Times, and the coverage of it in the New York Times is a lot more neutral than it is in the mainstream dailies in Canada. So in the major media organizations in Canada are portraying this as some minority fringe group of people, that are really no consequence other than the fact they're driving their trucks around. But I mean, if you look at the description of this from outside Canada, I think it's a more balanced observation that, you know, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with what's going on in Canada with these COVID restrictions and other things. How's this perceived in your part of the world?
You know, I haven't really had any conversations in my part of the world with people about it. But my thought on it is this. Very simply, people don't want COVID restrictions, right? I mean, I'm going to switch to the UK for a minute and look at what happened there, right? Boris Johnson got busted having these parties during lock when everybody was supposed to be locked down. And in order to try to get himself out of hot water, he knew exactly what the people wanted, which was to be released from COVID restrictions. This is what most people all over the world want, to be released from these restrictions, including in Canada. And in Canada, and I'm really, you know, I'm proud of the people in Canada for taking this up and going for freedom. Because the thing that's ridiculous to me, I get it. If you're scared of COVID and you want to protect yourself, stay home, wear a mask, take as many vaccines as you want. Nobody's stopping you. But for the rest of us that would like to get on with our lives, why should we all have to do this? And I find it so interesting that so many governments have had such massive restrictions on people's personal freedom. And when you go and talk to the actual citizens and residents of that country, 80, 90% disagree with what the government's doing. If 80, 90% of a population disagrees with what a government's doing, the government should say, okay, we're going to do what, if this is a government of the people, then we're going to do what these 80 or 90% of the people want us to do.
Well, you would think.
You would think.
Part of the problem now is that I think these governments are so invested in justifying their behavior over the last few years.
Sure.
So it's hard to figure out how to change course. I mean, the whole narrative on the effect of the vaccines was just shifting, has been shifting goalposts, you know, for the last couple of years.
The data seems to support, from what I've read, that the vaccines help, right? It doesn't really help you from getting it, but it seems to help that you're not going to wind up in the hospital or with a really severe case if you do get it. So I'm not anti-vaccine, but there certainly was a misrepresentation, right? I mean, if you look at what the media was a couple of years ago, it was, oh, these vaccines are going to protect you from getting it and all this stuff. And now, you know, the media saying, no, we never said that. We said it's just going to help it not be as bad. Well, that's not really true.
I don't think it's true either. I mean, my recollection when this whole thing started was that the vaccines were being marketed as a way to protect people from getting COVID at all.
Yeah, exactly.
And now, of course, it's completely changed.
But the point that I'm making is, I think a lot of the anger that people have towards their government, which at the end of the day results in them not getting value for their tax money. I think the governments in a lot of places, by mismanaging COVID and so severely depriving people of their rights and personal freedom, has accelerated revolution in a lot of places. It's kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. I think now that people are used to protesting and going out on the streets, we're going to see this happen more and more.
Well, I think that's probably true, but it's amazing to me to watch this unfold. I mean, I'm actually not watching it unfold because none of it's near me, you know, even though I live in downtown Toronto, or maybe it is, but I haven't seen it. But, you know, what I'm watching is would be the media wars on this, right?
Yeah.
You know, with one side trying to, say, no, I mean, there's very little support for these people, and the people who are involved are, you know, sort of right wing, horrible people, blah, 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 blah. And then on the other side, we have, No, I mean, these are people who are just basically taking a position on the whole COVID lockdown, et cetera. And, you know, their view should be accepted, you know, whatever. I mean, it's a very, very interesting thing. But I think it's particularly interesting that the beginning of what I actually could see as becoming a worldwide response to this, right, is actually originating in Canada, of all places.
Yes.
Never would have expected that. I was watching an interview with Ted Cruz last night. I think it was on Fox News, but whatever. But I mean, you know, he was saying, I mean, this is great. Canada's setting an example for the United States and the world.
I mean, the last time I saw big news, I mean, the last biggest piece of news I saw in Canada is when you guys tapped your national maple syrup reserves because there were shortages. So to see something like
that. I didn't know that. When was that?
You missed that? That was right around Thanksgiving. I never knew this, but apparently there's like the OPEC of maple syrup. And apparently prices were getting really high because of shortages. And you guys have a national stockpile of maple syrup. And the Canadian government decided to release some of it to ease the pressure on the market.
This is unbelievable. What Canadian, where are you getting your Canadian news? I think I should be watching.
It was like in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. Like, this was big news. This was like major media.
Unbelievable. Completely missed.
I'll Google it. I'll find the article. I'll send it to you. So I'm really, really happy to see something like this coming out of Canada. I think it's really good.
Oh, I think it's good, particularly since I don't think that people in Canada have a reputation for, you know, sort of actively standing up for their rights and that sort of thing.
Well, I think Canadians in general have a very favorable, I think most of the world has a very favorable view of Canadians as, you know, relatively well-balanced, you know, stable people. You don't see a lot of crazy things. No, but I mean, look, you don't see so many mass shootings and people from Canada going on around doing a bunch of nonsense. And so I think for Canadians to get up and do something like this really says something.
Well, it is interesting. And, you know, since we had this conversation this morning, I think I'm going to actually go down. You know, it's funny, I am more or less downtown, but go a few blocks downtown where the major hospitals and the legislature are and actually see what's going on this. But it is interesting. The purpose of this does seem to me to have shifted to some degree, though I do agree with that. I mean, it started, I think, a week or so ago with one more narrowly defined purpose, and now it's become a general sort of opposition or protest against more things the government is doing. I understand the prime minister has left Ottawa.
Really? I was not aware of this.
Well, of course, I don't know for sure, but I've seen that in multiple media sources. So I guess he must be taking this seriously.
Well, I mean, I think he's been pretty reckless with some of the things that he said about unvaccinated people. I think they're not very, not what you'd expect of a world leader.
No. It's absolutely terrible stuff. But I think that this may actually, it's a minority government. The Conservatives are going to have to get a new leader soon. And I think that this may have implications that are far more reaching than people imagine at the moment. But it's interesting, and I think it's good. But let's contrast that with Austria, which I understand now has a mandatory vaccination law. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. I certainly, you know, what's interesting. I mean, I certainly don't agree with it. I think that's really a very totalitarian thing of them to do. But, you know, the thing is, I don't know if it's because of of how most Austrians are educated or just the way of their thinking, but this is something that most Austrians are very in favor of, at least the ones that I know, which is really surprising to me, because some of my very best friends are Austrians. I think many of them are you know, very intelligent people. At least the ones I know are very sort of libertarian, freedom-oriented people. And for them to be on board with this, it was very shocking for me.
Well, you know, some of the stuff that I've read, sort of the equivalent of vaccine police, you know, walking around, you know, you're out on the street, show me your vaccination certificate and stuff. Oh my God, this is something.
Well, I did not read that. So that's new to me.
Yeah, that, well, I have read that. Now, whether it's true or not, we don't know. But if that were true, that would be an unbelievable escalation, I think, in a war against individuals.
I mean, look, I've always had a lot of respect for Austria and the way that they're governed. And I remember at the beginning of the pandemic when they first started talking about these vaccine passports, and Austria was vehemently against them, right? I mean, they were saying that this was, you know, a violation of human rights and all this stuff. And so to have seen them shift course to such a draconian totalitarian regime is highly surprising.
What is your understanding of what's going on in neighboring European countries?
I mean, I haven't really paid so close attention. I've been, you know, we've been pretty, I mean, since COVID started, we had a lockdown here in Dubai at the beginning of COVID, but they opened up in July of 2020 and things have been more or less, you have to wear a mask, but other than that, everything is normal here. And so I've pretty much been hanging out here and enjoying my freedom. I have not been spending as much time. I know that Spain has all but given up now. So they've reduced it from a pandemic to an epidemic and just said it's something we got to deal with. I know that there's been a few other countries. I think Denmark has also lifted all restrictions. So it seems to me like most of Europe is slowly moving in the direction of lifting restrictions.
Well, that might mean that sooner or later, Canada will be isolated in the world if it keeps this up.
Although, well, you guys in Austria.
Yeah, right. Although, you know, as you may know, the couple of weeks ago, the premier of Quebec was threatening a specific tax, a special tax on the unvaccinated. Yeah. Apparently, he has reversed course.
And, I read that.
There will be no special tax on the unvaccinated, which is of course good.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like you, I do see this as overall very much related to the tax system, because these tax systems have evolved to something way beyond taxation. They're now, you know, really expressions of how people should be living their lives.
Well, I think as you've so accurately stated in the past, they've become in many cases the constitutions of the countries. And now they seem to even be moving beyond that, right? To sort of, as you say, control how people live their lives.
Oh, there's absolutely no question about that. You know, coming back to the whole issue of taxation revolution, and I mean, surely you would agree that war is an expression of revolution.
Yes, absolutely.
One of the things in Mr. Adams' book that I've always found interesting, although I have never fully understood it, is his view that the Civil War, the American Civil War, was actually about taxation. And not, in fact, about slavery. Do you have any particular thoughts on that? And did you analyze that part of his book? Or
I read what he wrote in his book, that it had more to do about sort of taxation and moving that money from the South into the government so it could be pumped into the hands of the businesses of the North. I've not independently verified the truth of that.
Oh, there's no way to independently verify the truth. Yeah. But it's such an interesting
theory. For sure.
And it, you know, it makes you think that, you know, so, you know, the victors, of course, always write the history. And, you know, we have this, you know, right from kids in school, you know, we learn that the Civil War was for the purpose of ending slavery and all this sort of stuff. I mean, if somebody were, rather than to tell you that, okay, if somebody walked into a room and said, Jimmy, I heard that the purpose of the Civil War was to end slavery in the South, would you just accept that and say, that makes sense to me?
Well, I mean, listen, I did most of my grade school, or at least some of my, not most, but some of my grade school in the United States. And it's what they told me, and I believed it until I read Charles Adams's book. What I do think is really interesting about in the book, where he makes a really good point, is that if you look at some of Lincoln's campaign speeches and all this stuff in the beginning, you know, he's basically saying that slavery would be left alone. And then he did change course for whatever reason. So it does. And I don't believe that people change their beliefs just out of the goodness of their heart for no reason, usually, right? I mean, when people change course on something, it's usually because they're forced to.
Well, that could be. It's very, very interesting. And I've also found it very interesting how, you know, if you read a British-centric view of the American Revolution, the whole tax issue compared to the American one, I mean, how completely different they are.
I'm sure.
Well, it's pretty clear that that the whole tax issue is very, very much tied into the, you know, what I think is a growing sort of dissatisfaction with first world democracies and the way people are being treated. I read a very interesting article yesterday, which I'm going to actually email this to you. This might be worth a separate discussion, by Fareed Zakaria in 1997, where he makes the point, anybody who thinks about this would understand this, but you don't see this written out very often. And there's a huge difference between democracy and freedom. And that, you know, democracy is just, you know, how we decide who is in charge of the coercive power of government. And freedom is, of course, you know, what is the social political climate that people live in. And it does seem to me that, although on the one hand, I suppose we could say that Canada is a democracy, the United States is a democracy, et cetera, it does seem to me that this is clear proof there's no relationship at all between democracy and freedom.
I agree with that statement.
Would you rather live in a free country without democracy, or a democracy without a free country?
Freedom without democracy.
I think that's exactly right. And I think it's time people understand there's a huge difference. Democracy is definitely not a synonym for freedom, is it?
No, absolutely not. The two do not go hand in hand.
All right. Well, this has been, as always, a great discussion today. Do you have any concluding thoughts, concluding remarks on this?
No, I just think it's going to be interesting to see how this evolves. And when we get through this series of discussions, I really think that you and I need to go through Charles Adams's book and kind of come up with a timeline of the different steps that ultimately culminate in revolution, and see where we're at in that timeline compared to the past.
Absolutely. Very, very interesting. Okay, so if people want to get a hold of you this week before our next week discussion, how do they get a hold of you?
As always, you can find us at EsquireGroup.com and shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com to get in touch with us.
Excellent, excellent. And would you advise people to wear a mask?
That is up to them, their personal choice.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, thank you very much. Till next week.
Thank you.